Okay.
So, for those of you who weren't here, yes, you weren't with us yesterday and we had a similar abortion. Dr. Saunders, as you'll quickly find out, is not from around here. So can you tell us where you come from, how long you've been in medicine for, and what your current job is?
Well, I live in St. Albans, which is a town in England, but I come from the deep south, New Zealand, born in Christchurch. My wife's also a Kiwi, and we left New Zealand back in 1989 with two kids. We have three now, and we went and worked in East Africa with the Africa Inland Mission en route to coming to the UK, where we spent a couple of years at All Nations Christian College. And we thought we were going back to be career medical missionaries in Africa. God had other plans, and he tells us things on a need-to-know basis. And I ended up stepping right out of medicine. I was trained as a general surgeon. My wife's a pediatrician. And I went into full-time Christian ministry, doing student ministry with Christian Medical Fellowship in the UK and Ireland. And I did that for 8 years, and I've been the CEO of the same organization for the last 14 years. And CMF is an organization of Christian doctors and medical students. We have 4,500 doctors, 1,000 medical students throughout the whole of the UK and Ireland as well. We're a UK plus Ireland body. And we are affiliated with about 80 other national groups around the world in the International Christian Medical and Dental Association. So in leading a team of about 25 on staff, serving those members, public policy and ethics has been an area of interest for me, and I also work with an alliance called Care Not Killing, which brings together about 40 organisations. Some are healthcare providers, some are pro-life groups, some are faith groups, not all Christian, some are disability rights groups, and we're all united together with the aim of promoting good care and support for disabled and sick and elderly people, but also opposing any change in the law to allow assisted suicide or euthanasia. So that's the background.
So just to start us off in considering the issues at stake, could you clarify what the difference between euthanasia and assisted suicide is? And there's a lot of talk of the use of the phrase assisted dying as well. Could you tell us a bit about what the difference between those terms are and try and give us an idea of what precisely we're talking about?
Yeah. It's I think it's an Alice in Wonderland where they say, when I use a word, it means what I intend it to mean, nothing more and nothing less. But it's incredibly important in these areas that when we use words, we know what we mean, and other people know what we mean as well. And one thing that the pro-euthanasia movement do is, and I think they do this deliberately, is that they obfuscate and confuse terms and don't define things properly. And then as a result, people get confused about what they're really talking about. So it's incredibly important to define what we mean. When I talk about euthanasia, what I'm meaning is the intentional killing of a person whose life is felt not to be worth living. The intentional killing of a person whose life is felt not to be worth living, usually on compassionate grounds. And euthanasia can be voluntary, where the person asks for it. It can be involuntary, where they don't ask for it, but someone decides it's in their best interest anyway. Or it can be non-voluntary, where they're incapable of asking for it. You know, perhaps they have dementia, or head injury, or that they lack mental capacity to make those decisions, and therefore someone makes the decision on their behalf. So that's what euthanasia is. Now, assisted suicide is really, I think, euthanasia one step back. So it's where someone, usually a doctor, helps a person to take their own life rather than taking it for them. So from a practical point of view, euthanasia would often involve the injection of lethal drugs. Whereas on the other hand, assisted suicide usually involves the provision of lethal drugs which the patient then takes themselves by drinking them, but sometimes by pushing a syringe. And whereas these are two different categories, I would argue that they are essentially the same morally, ethically, philosophically, and so on. And they're the same because in both of these things, the intention is to end the life of the person. And from a Christian point of view, it's intention that's really key. And we'll come back to that when we look at the biblical material on this. But from a practical point of view, the difference between assisted suicide and euthanasia might be just a couple of centimetres. If you think about it, and I'm quoting Lord McColl here, who was a professor of surgery and a member of the House of Lords, but he says, if you put the medicine on the patient's hands, it's assisted suicide, but on their tongue, it's euthanasia. You might just have a centimetre or two difference. But the reason it's important to understand the difference is because legally it makes a huge amount of difference, because the two entities are dealt with under British law under two separate kinds of law with different processes, different penalties and all the rest. As well as, so you asked about assisted dying.
Yeah.
Let me say that assisted dying is a term that has been made up by the pro-euthanasia lobby. And usually not properly defined. It has no meaning in law or ethics at all. And I would argue that it's an illogical statement, because dying is something that happens to all of us anyway and doesn't involve a choice. But when they talk about assisted dying, they are actually talking about, in reality, assisted suicide for people who are terminally ill. That's what they really mean by it. And we'll come back to Lord Falkner's assisted dying bill later, but he defines it in that way. Across the pond in the US, they talk about aid in dying. It's the same kind of idea. But I think this is all about the battle for the language. And if you clothe things in euphemism, describe them in a certain way, and you don't define them properly, you've won half the argument in a sense. So just as it's important to define what euthanasia is, it's equally important to define what it isn't. And I think this is where a lot of people are confused, and a lot of Christians in particular, even some leading Christians are confused about this. There's three things that euthanasia is not. The first thing, when a mentally competent patient, someone who can make their own decisions, refuses treatment that you offer them, and they die as a result of that, that's not euthanasia. That's perfectly legal. In fact, if a doctor tries to intervene and give treatment in that case to a mentally competent patient, they can be held up for assault. So when a mentally competent patient refuses treatment, that's not euthanasia. The second thing, when a doctor withdraws or withholds treatment that is thought to be overly burdensome or meddlesome at the end, and the patient dies from their disease, that's not euthanasia. Now, some people call that passive euthanasia, but I think that's a very unhelpful term. We all know that at the end, and particularly when we die from certain kinds of diseases, it can be quite difficult, and the treatments for some diseases, particularly some sorts of cancer, can carry a real burden of their own. And as Christians, we recognize from the Bible that there is a time to die, and sometimes withholding and withdrawing treatment can be negligent, but there are other times when withholding or withdrawing treatment that's meddlesome and inappropriate and worse than the disease itself at the end is actually good medicine. And the key difference here is you ask, what's actually the patient dying from? That's the key thing. If they're dying from their disease, because you've decided not to give chemotherapy drugs which are going to make them vomit and their hair fall out in the last few days and not extend their life at all, then that's not euthanasia. But if they're dying from a drug you're giving them, that's something quite different. Now, the third misconception is, and this is probably the most difficult one to understand, and it's something that Lord Carey doesn't understand. So if you come out today knowing you'll know more than Lord Carey about this. But it's what we call double effect. Now let me explain it. If you're giving proportionate pain or symptom relief with the intention of easing someone's suffering, and as a result of that you shorten their life, then that is not euthanasia. And that's well recognized in theology and ethics. It's what we call double effect. You see, because the key thing is that your intention is to relieve the pain, not to kill them. You may foresee that their life might be shortened, but that's not your intention. Now, we call that double effect in ethics, but it's... along with that, it's incredibly important to understand that double effect in a clinical context with real patients virtually never, ever occurs if the doctor knows what he or she is doing. And the reason for that is that when you're attempting to relieve pain, the therapeutic dose that will either banish the pain or substantially alleviate it is always less than the toxic or lethal dose that will kill them. So in other words, if doctors are claiming that they have to kill the patient to kill the pain, then either they don't know what they're doing and they shouldn't be managing dying patients, or alternatively, they're just being disingenuous or dishonest about it. Because someone who's really skilled in palliative medicine will be able to titrate the dose against the symptom. So the sound, if you want me to put that in a soundbite, you can kill the pain without killing the patient, what I'm saying. Now, you might not be able to completely alleviate it, but you can substantially alleviate it. And in situations very, very close to death, when it is difficult, you can, if necessary, sedate the person in order to stop that. So we need to understand what it is and what it isn't.
That's great, thank you for that. I hope everybody understood, got that. So just to just sort of clear, can you tell us what the law is in the UK, so in England, Wales, Scotland, Northern Ireland, and then can you tell us which countries have legalised assisted suicide, which countries have legalised euthanasia and assisted suicide, and you know, what efforts are underway in other countries beyond the UK to change the law, because we'll come back to the UK later on.
Yeah. Well, euthanasia is illegal under what we call the murder law. It's not an act of parliament, it's common law. So it's law that's been established in the courts. But if you intentionally end someone's life, whether you're doing it for compassionate reasons or not, under the law, that's murder. And for that, you can go to prison. That the normal tariff is life in prison, which in practice means 15 years. If it's a particularly bad form of murder, it might be much longer than that. If it's less so or mitigating circumstances, it might be less than that. So that's the murder law under which euthanasia is convicted. Then there's the Suicide Act of 1961. Now, up until 1961, suicide was illegal. You've got to think about that. But what it meant in practice is if you tried to commit suicide and you weren't successful, you could actually be prosecuted up until 1961. And people changed the law because they said, well, people who commit suicide, they need our help rather than our conviction. And so there was a change in the way that the courts looked at it. But in 61, they retained the provision that if you assist a suicide, the words used to be aid, abet, procure, or counsel a suicide, then that is still a crime. Now those words have been changed. They were changed in 2009 under the Crimes and Justice Act to assist or encourage. And the reason they did that was that they wanted to catch people who were promoting suicide over the internet. I've heard of the Bridge End cluster, young people, predatory people, so that needs to tighten the wording up. But under the Suicide Act, if you are found guilty of assisting or encouraging a suicide, you can go to prison for up to 14 years, but there is discretion given both to the prosecutors and the judges. It's given to the prosecutors in the sense that they don't have to prosecute everybody who assists suicide. So the Department or the Director of Public Prosecutions, who heads up the Crown Prosecution Service, he asks himself, is there enough evidence to convict? And then, is it in the public interest to convict? And if the answer to both of those questions is yes, they'll go ahead and take it to court. And then it's up to the judge, if the person's found guilty, to decide how many years, up to 14. Now, in practice, we see very, very few convictions for assisted suicide. And those that we do see tend to not to be custodial sentences. In other words, they don't go to prison, but they get a rap over the knuckles. And yet, with the evidence that the law is working very well is the very, very small number of cases we see. And we would argue that the current law we have strikes a really good balance. On the one hand, it provides a powerful disincentive to exploitation and abuse by people, that people think twice about it. But on the other hand, it gives a lot of discretion both to prosecutors and judges to be compassionate or to temper justice with mercy in hard cases. But we think that blanket ban is the best way to go. Our opponents say this is a great British fudge. We say no, it strikes the right balance of justice and mercy. In the same way that if you had a law about speeding which said that, on the motorway, the speed limit's 70 miles per hour, unless of course you're late for an appointment, or your child's sick, or you didn't leave enough time to pick them up from school, or your wife's in labour, or whatever. We don't make all sorts of little exceptions, but we leave it for the judges, the prosecutors, police and so on to exercise discretion. And that's the same kind of law we have now. So currently there's a blanket ban on both assisted suicide and upon euthanasia.
And what's the case beyond the UK then? Certain countries have changed the law.
The first country to change the law was the Northern Territory of Australia, which is one area, big area, much bigger than Britain, but, a lot of kangaroos and not many people. So when they changed it back in the 1990s, about 6 months, four people died, they changed it back. At the moment, we've got four countries in Europe. So in the Netherlands and in Luxembourg, both euthanasia and assisted suicide are legal in certain circumstances. In Belgium, euthanasia is legal but not assisted suicide. And in Switzerland, assisted suicide is legal but not euthanasia. And then across the pond in the US, there are three US states which have changed the law, and those are Oregon and Washington, which are right in the northwest, up north of California. California's one of the only states that everyone knows where it is. So. And then there's Vermont, which is in the northeast, which more recently did, but there hasn't been a case yet in Vermont, as far as I know.
Yeah, no, that's really helpful. Could you tell us a bit about the experience in the Netherlands and Belgium, and also a little bit about Oregon, because that seems to be the area that the proponents of the Faulkner Bill have come on to really focus on. Could you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, very worrying what's happening. What we see, the longer this debate goes on, the more evidence comes out of these countries about what's happening. And what's coming out of the Netherlands and Belgium is particularly worrying. What we see is what we call incremental extension. I tend to use that term rather than slippery slope, because I think it's happening intentionally. And what we're seeing is, firstly, an increase in the numbers of cases. So in the Netherlands, since 2006, there's been 50 to 20% increase per year in the absolute numbers. Secondly, and in Belgium, it's over 500% increase in 10 years. Secondly, we see an expansion of the categories of people to be included. So what starts with terminally ill people then goes to chronically ill people. What starts with people who are mentally competent, you then start to get the mentally incompetent. So we're seeing the first dementia cases now in the Netherlands, or people with psychiatric illnesses as well. It starts with children, with adults, then extends to children. So Belgium have just legalised euthanasia for terminally ill children earlier this year. And in the Netherlands, even though it's illegal, under a protocol called Groningen Protocol, which is named after one of the cities in the Netherlands where this was developed, disabled children have been euthanized for many years. And in fact, this is in mainstream medical journals, particularly children with spina bifida or other conditions have been given lethal injections under the law. And we're not seeing any prosecutions of doctors in any of these cases. The other thing what we're seeing in the Netherlands is that there's more and more fudging of statistics. So the question is, what is euthanasia? Well, the only cases they count as euthanasia are those who are given lethal injections of barbiturates by doctors with the intention of killing them. What they don't count are a whole lot of other end-of-life decisions which are made with the explicit intention of ending life. Now, and I mean, for example, withdrawal or withholding of treatment with the intention of killing the patient rather than, you know, being good medicine. Morphine overdoses with the intention of killing, not just to relieve pain. But probably the biggest category of all is what we call deep sedation. And deep sedation accounted for 5% of Dutch deaths back in 2005. By 2008 it was 8%. By 2012 it was 12.5%. And to put it in layman's terms, what that involves is you give people this massive slug of sedatives to render them unconscious, and then you withdraw food and fluid, and so they die within a week or so. But again, the intention is to end the life. And it's very interesting, if you look at the Netherlands and look at the death rates in every age group, you'll find that in most age groups, Netherlands is the top of the class in Europe. In other words, it's a better place to live than anywhere else in terms of the medical care and your chances of surviving. But there are two age groups, the very old and the very young, where the Netherlands is substantially worse than the rest of Europe, and I think that's all related to that. In the same way, in Switzerland, what's been very alarming under the Swiss law is people with chronic diseases, people with arthritis, diabetes, mental illness, people who are perfectly well but can't bear the fact that their husband or wife is dying, are being bumped off, and we're seeing in Switzerland a lot of gruesome stories that are coming out, body bags in apartments and cremation urns being dredged out of Lake Zurich where they were being dumped, and personal effects being sold off and so on. But when we go to Oregon and Washington, we have a different law. It's assisted suicide only. The numbers are lower, but there's also a lot of things that are really concerning about that. We're seeing incremental extension in both Oregon and Washington. Numbers go up every year. We're seeing also that people are being offered assisted suicide rather than treatment. And there are two very famous cases, a woman called Barbara Wagner, a man called Randy Stroop. Both of them had cancer, and they applied to the Oregon Health Department for treatment for their cancer chemotherapy drugs. And the health department wrote back and said, well, we can't provide you drugs, but we could give you assisted suicide. Now, the interesting thing was that neither of them had actually asked for that. But what happens is that once you legalize assisted suicide, then health suppliers and economists and health services begin to think of it as a treatment option, you see. And so, okay, you've got cancer, well, we could give you palliative care, addressing your symptoms, we give you chemotherapy, or we could offer you assisted suicide. But actually, when we look at the cost, palliative care, £3,000 or £4,000 a week, it's quite expensive. Chemotherapy, probably a lot more than that. Assisted suicide was just five quid for a glass of barbiturate, and the problem over. So do you see the pressures that might be felt, both by families under pressure or by health departments or health economists in that kind of environment, particularly at a time of recession when the families' health services are struggling. So that's another alarming thing. Another thing is that when you look at the reasons that people give for making use of the service, they're not medical reasons. In Oregon, 93% say loss of autonomy or choice is their reason. 89% say loss of enjoyable activities, the things that, you know, that I enjoy doing. 73% it's loss of dignity. When you talk about pain, we're way down at 23%. And that's not just pain, but actually the fear that pain might come. And they don't discriminate between them. So in other words, people are killing themselves largely for what we call existential reasons, loss of meaning and hope, nothing to do with symptoms at all. And the most alarming thing in Washington, 61% last year, so 6 out of 10 said that they were taking their life because they felt they were a burden on people. And this is one of the most powerful reasons for not changing the law, is that if you do make it an option, then there are people who are vulnerable, whether they're disabled or sick or elderly, who feel that they're a burden on others, whether it's family or society or the health service, that either emotionally or financially they're a burden and that they should do the decent thing. So the problem is that the right to die can so easily become the duty to die. Other problems, only 3% get a psychiatric assessment, but we know that at least a quarter of them are depressed, and depression, which is usually treatable, is very common in terminal illness. We know people have been given lethal drugs in Oregon and they're still alive four years later. That was meant to be a six-month life expectancy thing. So doctors are pushing the limits on this. In many cases, doctors are... there's doctor shopping going on, so certain doctors are known to be open to this and you know, having known the patient for less than a week, they're prescribing it. And it's just impossible to know the kind of dynamics that are operating in families and the subtle pressures that might be there and the coercion that's either overt or just a felt duty to anyone's life. So I think, thank you
for that very good survey of what the situation is. We're probably going to move on now to consider the biblical case against assisted suicide and euthanasia. Everyone here should have a copy of a booklet that Dr. Saunders has written. It's part of CARE's Live and Let Live campaign. If you don't have one, you can come and get them from the stand that CARE has in the mission exhibition. And if you'd like some more, please do feel free to come and get them. Could you just provide for us a brief outline of the biblical case against assisted suicide and euthanasia?
Well, some people think the Bible says nothing about euthanasia, because if you look up euthanasia on Bible Gateway or the Concordance if you're a bit older, you know, you won't find it. There are actually two cases of euthanasia in the Bible, which are quite interesting. The first one involves Saul. Remember bad King Saul in the Old Testament? And you remember right at the end, he was fighting against the Philistines, and he and his son Jonathan were both attacked, and he was dying on Mount Gilboa, and an Amalekite soldier comes up and he finds him there, and Saul is still alive. He's got a penetrating abdominal injury because he's fallen on his own sword, and he begs the Amalekite to kill him. And the Amalekite does, and he goes and, you know, tells David he's done it, expects to be rewarded, and David doesn't welcome him, and the Amalekite pays for it with his life. So you might say, well, there's a case of compassionate death or whatever, put him out of his misery. Compassion is one of the main arguments, of course. So the other case involves another bad egg, a chap called Abimelech in the book of Judges. And they call Abimelech the anti-judge because he was a guy who went around killing large numbers of people. And anyway, as the story goes, he was storming a tower and a woman took a millstone and threw it out and hit him on the head. And as he lay dying, he said to his armor bearer, please kill me with your sword so it cannot be said that a woman killed Abimelech. And we might say, you know, he wanted death with dignity. So we have compassion and death with dignity, and those two arguments. Of course, you know, these stories are interesting. We can't derive strong biblical teaching from narrative stories, but nonetheless they're interesting. So when we ask what does the Bible say about it, it's a matter of looking at the timeless principles that are there in scripture and then applying them to contemporary situations. So God did not write about euthanasia and use those words, but he put the principles in scripture because he foresaw that it was going to be an issue for us later on. And so I think we start by saying every human being is made in the image of God, regardless of the age, disability, ethnicity or whatever. We're all incredibly precious in God's sight. And it's on the basis of that in Genesis 1 that after the flood, the first inkling of the sixth commandment, you shall not kill, comes when God says to Noah, if anyone sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed, because in the image of God is God made man. Genesis 9, 6 and 7. And that, if you like, provides the framework for the sixth commandment that follows in Exodus 20 and Deuteronomy 5. So that's where we start, that we're made in the image of God, but more than that, we belong to God. Our lives are not our own. And therefore, to take what belongs to God, whether it's someone else's life or our own life, is morally wrong. And this was formalized in the sixth commandment, which we all know as you shall not kill. And that raises the question, well, you know, what does it actually mean? And we have to look at the passages in the Old Testament, there are some in that booklet, which expound that commandment and explain it in more detail. And what we come out with is a very, very clear definition, which has been picked up and put into law all over Europe and is the basis of our own laws. And what it's talking about, what does kill mean in that context? It's talking about the intentional killing of an innocent human being. Intentional, to distinguish it from manslaughter, where you didn't intend to kill a person. Of a human being, to distinguish it from the killing of animals or other species. And innocent, to distinguish it from certain circumstances under Old Testament law where it was admissible to take life. So there were exceptions when human beings could take life in the context of holy war, what we'd say just war today, or in self-defense, or for various capital offenses that were like murder and rape and so on. But all the way through scripture, you'll find that there's a ban, absolute ban on the shedding of innocent blood, the intentional killing of an innocent human being, even if the person asks for it. And that's been picked up in law, but it's also been picked up in medical ethics as well. And the Hippocratic Oath, which doctors used to all sign, has the same principle in it. So we're made in the image of God. It's wrong to take human life. Human life belongs to God. But then, of course, we're called to go way beyond mere Old Testament legalities to the very foundation of love on which the law is built. So it's not enough just for us to say, well, I'm not going to kill people, because we know that, you know, even to hate someone is equivalent to killing. So we're to love people, and we're to care for them, and we're to expend our time and resources in looking after them. And I think that whole principle of compassion, as modelled in the life of Christ and the apostles, has found its expression in the hospice movement and in palliative medicine and in medicine. The first Christian doctor was Luke. He wrote two books in the New Testament. And right back from the beginning, there have been a whole trail of Christian doctors and nurses and others who have seen themselves as following in the footsteps of the great physician, Jesus Christ, and providing care, which might be curative, might be palliative, just relieving symptoms, but that's an expression of Christ. And so the hospice movement has its very strong foundation in that.
So if I could just come in here, so you kind of expounded there the biblical view of why you believe suicide and euthanasia is being wrong. People here may know that Archbishop Carey and Desmond Archbishop and Bishop Tutu came out recently in favour of assisted suicide, saying it was more biblical to believe that was the right way forward. I just want to make sure I get what Desmond Tutu said. He says that we should revere the sanctity of life, but not at any cost. Why do you think that they're wrong?
Well, I go into more depth on this in my blog, but if you Google why Lord Carey is so desperately wrong about assisted suicide. You'll find it in much more detail. I've done one on Tutu as well. I think Carey, first of all, misunderstands double effect, as I tried to explain earlier on, and that he, in effect, if you read what he says, buys into the idea that, you know, we're doing it anyway by killing people with morphine. But I argue that, actually, in good hands, we're not doing that at all. And that giving a lethal barbiturate injection is something completely different than trying to relieve pain. But I think Carey misunderstands what compassion is. If we look at compassion from a biblical context, it's actually a good exercise to go through the New Testament and look at every point where the word compassion comes up, and most of them apply to the life and ministry of Christ. And in each of those circumstances, he has compassion on them, and so he feeds them, he heals them, ministers to them, or whatever. But these are all things to make the lot of these people better and to relieve suffering. We don't see him going beyond that. Now, you might argue that we don't have the miraculous powers of Christ, but Christians following in Christ's footsteps over the centuries have seen it this way, that I can't kill this person, so what can I do? And it's that that's driven medicine and palliative care to develop in the way that they have, that there are boundaries we must not cross. So I think he misunderstands that. But what really disappointed me most of all, and I have a lot of respect for Lord Carey, but I read his piece in some detail, and we had to respond to it as well. What disappointed me most of all was that there was no real Christian theological framework in what he was saying at all, I didn't think. There's nothing about human beings being made in the image of God. There was nothing about the moral absolute of the sixth commandment. There seemed to be a naivety as well about what happens when you change the law, that the reason we need laws is to restrain the heartless or people who might take liberties. There was nothing about Christian hope beyond death. There was nothing about perseverance and patience. There was surprisingly little reference to the hospice movement or palliative care. And I don't know what's driven him to take this position, but we must note that with Carey, he's now at odds with 2,500 years of medical ethics and at odds with 2,000 years of Christian teaching. And it was striking, I think, that the Anglican Church responded very quickly by coming out and distancing themselves. And but Justin Welby, on the very same day Carey was published, appeared in an article in the Times saying that it was dangerous and inadvisable to go down this route. So he's put himself at odds with the church. Tutu, I thought, was even more worrying than Carey. And Tutu's clearly been influenced by the Mandela case. And we know that he was a good friend of Mandela, and when Mandela was dying at the end, they didn't want to let him go. And they kept him alive. And I think they kept him alive inappropriately with all kinds of interventions, and they had him on a ventilator. And it was much more driven by, we can't bear him to go, than thinking, how can we ease his natural death in the best possible way short of killing him? So I think Tutu was reacting to that, what I'd call a kind of inappropriate vitalist approach, which is completely unchristian anyway, but he's overreacting. And he overreacted to the point where he's now advocating lethal injections and assisted suicide. But the two things that most worried me about Tutu were, first of all, what were the arguments he gave? The first argument, and you can, again, on my blog, I've linked through to the full statement that he made. You can go and read it and see it yourself. But there's two things that really worried me. The first was he seemed to imply that there were too many old people on the planet, and that they were consuming too many resources, and that it was their duty to cut short their lives in order to look after all the young people. Now, I just see that as completely and utterly at odds with everything in Christianity, which is all about love being bearing the burdens of others and making sacrifices for others. And to be totally blunt, we all went through a period early in life when we needed to be clothed and fed and had our bottoms wiped. And some of us need that at the other end of life, some of us. And it's all about the strong making sacrifices and laying down their lives for the weak. That is the Christian ethic. And all of us at times in our lives will be a burden upon others financially or emotionally or otherwise, and that's just part of being human. And being Christian is being mutually burdensome, and that's something to celebrate. So, but I think he was into that whole sort of overpopulation idea, which I think is dangerous, if we come back to that maybe. But the other thing he said is that I think that when people need help to breathe, then, you know, we've gone too far. And again, he was talking about Mandela. But I think of two very good friends of mine who have a condition called sleep apnea, and they're on a what's called a CPAP machine, which helps them breathe at night, and they can't survive without it. If they didn't have it, then they'd die. And both of them are household names, international conference speakers, and Christians who go all around the world. But they need technology to help them. And there are many people who require technology of some sort, you know, whether it's drugs or a ventilator or, you know, some kind of aid to help them. I have many friends in the disability rights community, and many of them with serious disabilities live right on the edge of life and death, and you never quite know when something's going to come over and push them over the edge and their life will be over. And I've lost a number of good friends in the last few years. They go in hospital and just don't have the resilience. And yet, with the right technology to help them, they function at an incredibly high level in society. I think of Baroness Jane Campbell in the House of Lords, who on the day the Falconer Bill was debated, and she's there with her oxygen mask going all day, and she's speaking in the House of Lords, and she could, you know, they wheeled her out, and you know, you don't want to talk to her because she's so short of breath, but she says, "Let me decide." We don't want assisted dying, she said. We want assisted living. And it's interesting that it's not just the medical profession that's against this. It's the disability rights groups as well. Every single disability rights group, every major one in the whole of Britain and Ireland, is opposed to a change in the law. And they're not coming from a faith perspective.
So we just come to my last question, which is about the Falconer Bill, and I'll open it up to the floor if you have any questions for Dr. Saunders. Could you tell us about what the aims of the Falconer Bill were? It only applied to England and Wales, I think, not Northern Ireland, but why people in Northern Ireland should be concerned about what Lord Falconer was proposing to do, and why you personally felt so strongly that you had to oppose it. Yeah.
The Lord Falconer's Bill was called the Assisted Dying Bill. It's the third attempt we've seen in the House of Lords in the last 7 years to change the law on this. He was involved in one of the previous ones as well. But what he's attempting to do is provide for people who are mentally competent, in other words, they can decide for themselves, adults, 18 or over, terminally ill, and he defines that as 6 months or less to live, and with a settled wish to end their lives, those are the four provisions, to have assisted suicide with the help of a doctor. But those are the entry criteria, if you like, to it. Why are we worried about it? Yeah. Well, for a start, we don't think it's safe to legislate in this area at all, but this particular bill is absolutely, it's like Swiss cheese, it's full of loopholes. And if you think about those four conditions, first of all, mentally competent, actually very difficult to assess for an ordinary doctor, even for a psychiatrist. You can't do it reliably on one visit. You have to know the person over time. Adult. Well, we know once, if this law got through, then we'd have a case of someone who's 17 or 16, but who qualifies in all the other regards, and they'd argue that they do have the competence to make the decision. We've seen this in other areas like, you know, contraception, abortions. Terminally ill. What I can tell you, as a doctor who's looked after many dying patients, you cannot estimate with reliability how long they're going to live. And we all get taught very early on, don't say 6 months, don't say 12 months or whatever. Talk in terms of, you know, days rather than weeks, or weeks rather than months, and, you know, be very vague, because you cannot predict for individuals. You might be able to do for populations. Mm-hmm. And we've seen the evidence of this in Oregon, where you know, people just get it wrong. Mm-hmm. But more than that, people will stretch the boundaries. Settled wish to die. Again, how do you tell what's really happening in a family, and what subtle pressures are being exerted, or what duties people feel? Doctors are not gods, and they're not good at assessing these sorts of things. You know, think how often most people go to the doctor. But I tell you what worries me as a doctor is that this bill gives far too much power to doctors. It gives power that they should not be entitled to have. And when we look at the equivalent piece of legislation, the Abortion Act in Britain, we see how that's been abused. Now, if you look at the Abortion Act of 67, it's actually quite restrictive in its entry criteria. You've got to tick the various boxes. But we know that about 98% of all abortions in Britain fall outside the bounds of the Act. So the doctors just think, well, I think she deserves an abortion. No matter what it says, I'm going to sign the form. In some cases, sign the form even before seeing the patient. And if Falkland's Law went through, it will be doctors who assess, doctors who sign, doctors who take responsibility, and doctors should not have that power, because some will push the boundaries, and the bill gives no provision for bringing them to account. In fact, Falkland has said himself that if the doctor genuinely believes, there's no way the law can touch them. But in addition to that, all the other safeguards are the same so-called safeguards that have been repeatedly rejected before in Britain, and which we've seen do not work in places like Oregon and the Netherlands. So we were against it, obviously, from Christian conviction, but we were also against it just in terms of its practicability. And you know, why is it that disability rights activists who don't share our Christian convictions are standing with us really strongly on this? It's because they know that people make judgments about the value of their lives, and they know the pressure that they would be put under with this kind of legislation, which is why they don't want to go down that whole route. And so why do we get involved? Well, because of all that, but also because we passionately believe that in a democracy, we're all responsible, and we have a Christian duty to do what we can to make sure that the laws on our statute books are just and fair. And all of us will one day have to stand before the Lord and give account. And as members of the society, rather like Daniel and his friends, we're not to withdraw, but we're to be fully engaged in society and trying to be salt and light. And I think particularly there's a responsibility for Christians to speak, to be a voice for the voiceless, and also to protect those who are easily marginalised or vulnerable from exploitation and abuse. So that's why I think it's important.
And why do you think that people in Northern Ireland, when our assembly isn't going to pass this, should care about this bill?
Well, I think you should care about your brothers and sisters in other countries.
Yeah, absolutely.
But more than that, it will come here eventually. If it's allowed to progress. And if you'd asked me 20 years ago, when we were in the early 90s, when there was pressure to change the law, that we'd get to 2014 and the law still hadn't changed in Britain, I wouldn't have believed it. I would have bitten your hand off for that, even 5 years ago. So we've actually been extraordinarily encouraged at the slow pace at which this is moving. And the pro-euthanasia lobby are very frustrated about this, that they've only got four countries, they've only got three US states. And in the US, there have been over 120 attempts to change the law in different states, and all of them have been defeated. And that's because when people hear the arguments, they change their minds. And in fact, as I say, every time a British parliament's looked at this issue, they've decided, regardless of their ideological convictions, that's just not safe
And I think it's just before I open the floor, just to say that Dignity and Dying is launched in Northern Ireland. There are active attempts to lobby members of the Assembly to change the law in this area, so we aren't exempt from the argument going on in the rest of the UK. So does anyone have any questions that they'd like to put? Or I'll just continue asking. Yes, the man at the back there.
What pressures are on Christian doctors now within the UK or beyond? If the pressure is to conform and administer, how are they going to be tracked or caught in the corner?
Well, at the moment, the law is, with the law as it is, there's not pressure because it's illegal. What's interesting is that in the jurisdictions that have changed the law, they've generally been those where the medical profession is has been weak or in favour of it. And that's certainly true in the Netherlands and Belgium. In Quebec, the law has just changed, but it's being appealed here. And the Quebec Medical Association was in favour or didn't stand against it. I think we're fortunate here in the UK that the British Medical Association is against. All the major royal colleges, College of Physicians, surgeons, GPs, the Association for Palliative Medicine, British Geriatric Society, they're all against the change in the law. And if you survey individual doctors, you find they're about two-thirds against. So that's all been helpful. What would happen if the law did change? Well, there is a conscience clause in Falconer's Bill, which would offer some protection. Just as there's a conscience clause in the Abortion Act, so you don't have to be involved in abortion. But we know there's a lot of subtle pressure put on people to be involved in abortion. And there's a huge argument going on in the Supreme Court, shortly to resume, about what aspects of abortion people can be exempted from and what bits they have to be involved in. And the way the medical profession think about this is that within a particular specialty, you're obliged to provide the full range of treatments in that specialty. Now, at the moment, assisted suicide is not part of the full range of treatment. But if the law were to change, it would be part of the full range of treatment options in general medicine, general practice, geriatrics, intensive care, virtually every specialty, possibly with the exception of dermatology, although some people do die of skin disease. So there would be pressure put on people. And we know that, if you take the example of contraception, we know that there are some contraceptives that act after the time of fertilization. The intrauterine contraceptive device is an example of that. There is one form of morning after pill, Elawand, which we know acts after fertilization. Now, the Royal College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists will not let you get a postgraduate qualification, a diploma or fellowship in sexual and reproductive health unless you're willing to provide the full range of treatment. So there is already discrimination against doctors. If the law were to change on euthanasia, it would happen as well. And I was doing a debate actually on BBC Radio Ulster.
Yeah, with Stephen
Orr. No, it wasn't Stephen Orr this time. It was some, I don't remember the guy's name. He was a philosopher from Northern Ireland. Okay. Quite dodgy. anyway, it went something like this.
I'm not being
able to put it all. No, I can't even remember his name. But anyway, so it was about this contraceptives. And he said, okay, Christian doctors who aren't prepared to provide the full range of treatments in obstetrics and gynecology should not be able to practice in those areas. So I said, so if euthanasia became legal, would that mean that Christian doctors who objected it should not be able to practice in all these areas of medicine? And the reason I asked him that, because he's a philosopher, and philosophers have to be logically consistent, and I knew he'd answer as he did. He said, yes, definitely they should not be able to practice in any of these areas of medicine. So I said, so what you're telling me is that a doctor who wants to abide by the Hippocratic Oath should not be able to practice medicine. Is that what you're saying? well, isn't that interesting? In just a generation, we've gone from the point where the whole medical profession is opposed to this, to you saying that people who believe what doctors have believed for 2,000 years shouldn't be able to practice. But there will be people who make those kind of suggestions. And that's another reason why we had to stand against it, because it won't just affect healthcare professionals, but it will affect others as well.
Anyone else have a question? Ah, yes, sorry, go ahead.
You mentioned about in the Netherlands about the children being euthanized, and what can we do to stop this, or how can we be involved in trying to prevent this?
Well, I think the first thing is to be aware of it. I think then you have to have the references and data to prove it, because when you say it, people don't believe you. I said this on BBC Five Live, Nicky Campbell, and I was up against a guy from the National Secular Society, and I said, in the Netherlands, babies was fine, but they're being killed under the euthanasia law, even though it's illegal. And Andy Copson from the National Sexual Society says, that's a lie. And I said, no, it's not. It's in the New England Journal of Medicine. That's my quote. And then I came off. He was so angry. I come out of the studio. My phone goes. It's Five Live. And they say, what's your evidence for saying this? You see. And so I said, well, look, I'm in the middle of the street outside Parliament, and I haven't got it with me, but I'll email it to you in 10 minutes. And so they questioned me in great detail about this. And then Nicky Campbell and Copson were having a go at me on Twitter, you know, about Saunders lying and all of this on national radio and so on. So I went back to my desk. I picked out the paper from the New England Journal of Medicine, which described 23 cases in 5 years, and made the estimate that there were 20 to 30 cases actually. And I sent it to them. Of course, I heard nothing more from them. I went back to Nicky Campbell on Twitter, and he said, oh, Peter, I'm sorry, I'm walking my dog, and I'm too busy to... So we've got to have the data. That's really important. And then we have to let people know about it. And most people, when they're here, are outraged. And then we put pressure. So what we're doing now, for example, in Belgium, is using people within Belgium and their stories and making them more public. So, for example, there is a university lecturer in Belgium by the name of Tom Mortier, and Tom's mother was killed by Will Distelmans, who's one of the leading euthanasia doctors. And the first thing Tom knew about it was he got a phone call from the hospital to say, could you come and pick up your mother's personal effects? He said, why? She said, well, she had euthanasia yesterday and her personal effects are here. That was the first thing he knew. Now, his mother had a history of chronic depression, and in the middle of one of these episodes, she asked for her life to be taken, and Distelmans gave her a lethal injection. And that's how Tom Mortier got involved in this whole process. And this is the kind of thing that's happening. So, what we need to do for cases like that is get them into the national media, get them in, because often they won't be published in Belgium, but if you get them published somewhere else, then it begins to put pressure on Belgium. And I think what we need to do is isolate the Netherlands and Belgium and expose what's happening and get it out. We find with Dignity in Dying, they never want to talk about Netherlands or Belgium. Never. So we always try and talk about it. We like to talk about Oregon,
yes,
because Oregon, the numbers are lower. But actually, as I said before, there are lots of worrying things that are coming out of Oregon as well.